today, looking back at the environmental campaigns that fought and won.
It's really easy to feel overwhelmed by the environmental emergencies because they are overwhelming.
Experts say that we have until 2030 to avoid catastrophe.
UK scientists are saying the bushfires in Australia are a warning of what may be to come around the world.
Earth's average surface temperature has risen by nearly 2 degrees Fahrenheit since the late 19th century.
If unprecedented changes are not made and made soon, there will be irreversible damage to the planet.
Barely a week goes by without The Guardian's environment correspondent Fiona Harvey reporting on the devastating impacts of the climate emergency. But she has also written about the moments when people have come together to effect permanent and lasting change to the planet.
It's really important to remember that we have more power than we think, because it's very easy to start to feel powerless in this struggle. And so looking back at the activists of the past, it must have seemed impossible that they would succeed. And yet they did. In some really important battles, they did. And we should celebrate that.
She's been writing about three important climate battles: the removal of lead from petrol, eliminating acid rain, and closing the hole in the ozone layer. Fiona argues that victories like these make environmentalism the most successful citizens' movement there has ever been. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, is the key to tackling the climate crisis to look to the past?
Next time you buy gasoline, drive up to the pump with the Ethel emblem and say, fill her up.
There's a difference, a powerful difference between gasoline
and Ethel.
Gasoline!
Lead started to be put in petrol in the 1920s, but we knew for a long time that it was harmful. I mean, lead is a terrible poison. The effects of it, if you have it in large enough quantities, it can kill a person. But even in smaller quantities, it can affect all of the organs of the body, but it can affect the cardiovascular system. But it can particularly affect the brain, and it can affect the developing brain the most. So children are at great risk from lead. And yet what we were doing was every single car, every vehicle on the road had lead put into it every day, and this was coming out in clouds in the air, essentially, invisibly, but it was there and we were all breathing it in.
Which is horrific. So why was it in the fuel in the first place?
It was there to make the engines run better. It was found out in the 1920s that lead had these properties to prevent this thing called knocking in engines.
But with high-octane ethyl gasoline, there is no knock. The burning gases give the piston a smooth, powerful push. And that's the difference.
Sam, it took some years to actually get the science together to prove that the lead was coming from exhausts and it was accumulating in children and it was affecting their development. Because every step of the way, the scientists and the campaigners who were arguing this were countered by the industry, who tried to cast doubts on the science, first of all, or who said, oh, that's not enough, we need more studies, which is a delaying tactic we're familiar with in other environmental crises. Or they just tried to say that, okay, even if the science is true and lead is poisoning children, it's too expensive to get rid of it.
By 1970, the US had begun phasing lead out from petrol, but this wasn't the case in the UK, something that disturbed campaigner Janet Alty.
I and my husband and two small children lived in the States. My husband was part of Dartmouth College, and I was very aware that the lead in petrol campaign had been won in America. I came back to UK in 1971 and found that there was no unleaded petrol available. And I thought, come on, guys, what's going on? So that's when the campaign started.
So what did you do, Janet? Where did you start with your campaigning?
My way of doing things is always the same. I write it down. I produce a leaflet that's got the facts on it and explaining why lead is such a terrible thing, for particularly for young people. We used to just stand on there's a place in Leamington where you can stand on put up a table and stand there and give out leaflets and talk to people, you know, get signatures on campaigns. And we did a lot of that. But you have to remember there was a huge campaign by the people who made the lead additive, and indeed the automotive industry that made the engines. They said, oh, we can't possibly not have lead it, but you just have to keep banging on and banging at the door.
Janet became part of a much bigger movement launched in 1981 called CLEAR, the Campaign for Lead-Free Air, which forced a national conversation about leaded petrol.
This road is very busy, yes, and the children are always waiting for the buses to go past with lots of exhaust puffing out, and there's no way they can escape it.
Well, it's quite disturbing, yes. It's not very pleasant to live in an environment that's going to be rather damaging to your health in the end.
The campaign was supported by wealthy donors and gained traction in the media.
So, what's to stop us changing to lead-free petrol? Well, let's find out by discussing it with Anthony Fraser, who is the director of the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders, together with Dr. Robin Russell-Jones, a member of CLEAR's Scientific and Medical Advisory Board. As you might expect, we had invited the UK Petroleum Industry Association to take part in our discussion, but they told us they didn't wish to appear on a programme alongside someone from the medical profession, so they declined our invitation.
It was really right around between 1979 and 1983 that the crucial period was, where you had this national coordinated campaign and that really got some political clout, and it was 1983 that you got the politicians moving. Of course, it still took some time. It was a Conservative government at the time in the 1980s in the UK, and I think there was an idea that if you put unleaded petrol on the market alongside leaded, then people could choose the unleaded and leave it to the free market. But of course, that's not really a valid choice, because at first, unleaded petrol was more expensive.
Well, time for a drop of petrol, unleaded, of course. Now, this time last year, the sales of unleaded were only about 1% of the total, although there was a lot of interest. We had over 7,000 requests for these information leaflets when we did an item last October.
The government could have intervened much sooner to level that and to say, we'll tax leaded petrol more heavily than we tax unleaded, to give people an incentive. And they didn't do that for years. It was, I'm told, by one of the campaigners, that it was the Chancellor at the time, Nigel Lawson, now Lord Lawson, who prevented the change to the tax regime that would have benefited unleaded petrol.
Your campaign was successful. What lessons have you taken from it over the recent years?
Well, you have to start off by knowing you're right. You have to be very firm in your view that this is the right thing to do and this is the right campaign to make progress on. So that's the start. And then you talk to other people and they see how right it is, and then they see that they must do something about it.
Fiona, we've talked about the lead campaign, but what was the next big environmental moment you decided to focus on?
If we look at the campaign against acid rain, particularly in the United States, then I think we get some really interesting lessons there.
And now, acid rain in the news. Acid rain looks, feels, and smells like any other rain, but the water in acid rain carries poisons like sulfuric acid.
Acid rain was coming from burning coal, mainly from coal-fired power plants. Coal, as well as spewing out carbon dioxide when it's burnt, coal also produces these sulfur compounds, which when they get up in the atmosphere, fall as an acid form of rain. And when acid rain accumulates in rivers and lakes, it kills fish and other aquatic life.
Big Moose Lake in upstate New York looks great from the surface, but underwater is another story.
About 30 years ago, residents started noticing that fish in the lake were dying. Today, very few fish survive there at all.
The effects on nature were horrific. The pollution would get up into the atmosphere, it'd be carried along by the winds, and then it would fall as rain somewhere else. So in the United States, because of the direction of the prevailing winds and so on, although the pollutants were coming from the United States, very often the rain was falling in Canada. Similarly, in Europe, the UK was producing a lot of the acid rain from its coal-fired power plants, but the rain was falling in Scandinavia. So that's a really interesting problem because it crosses borders. And the only way to solve a problem like that is for governments to get together, but then the governments have got to deal with industry. And so the government in the United States had an interesting way of dealing with this. Rather than simply say to the industries, right, stop polluting, what they did was to set up a system of cap and trade. And what that means is that the industries involved in producing acid rain were given a cap on the amount of pollution they could produce, which was to be gradually brought down over a period of years. Every company is given a number of permits to produce the pollutants. And there's a limit on the number of the permits that are given to each company. And what these companies can do is they can trade these permits with each other. So that means that if you are a company that moves quickly to reduce your pollution, then you've got spare permits and you can sell them to the companies that are moving more slowly.
I mean, it sounds great. Did it work?
Yeah, because these industries, you know, they're used to competing with one another. And so this was something they understood. You know, they could see that they could get one over on their rivals by having spare permits to sell. And they knew because the cap was going to be tightened and tightened, the amount of permits available was going to be reduced and reduced and reduced over time. They could see that they were going to have to do this eventually.
And what impact did this have on acid rain?
It was so successful that the rivers that were once dead and the lakes where nothing could live, they're now teeming with fish and aquatic life. The forests have regenerated. Really, there is very little evidence left in most places that this problem was ever a scourge. There are some places in China where acid rain is a problem. But really, in the areas where it was a terrible problem in the 1980s, it has been solved.
So big companies in this case were incentivized to regulate their polluting output. But have you seen examples of this cap and trade agreement or others like it being used since to improve the environment?
Well, the same form of cap and trade system can also be used in climate change because you can have a system of permits for producing carbon dioxide. And that has had some success. So, for instance, in Europe, heavy industry that produces carbon dioxide are regulated under a cap and trade system. There are parts of the United States that have a cap and trade system. There are systems in operation in other parts of the world. However, there were hopes that there would be a global cap and trade system by now. In the Kyoto Protocol, there were plans for a global cap and trade system on carbon dioxide. Didn't quite work out, was never actually fulfilled.
I think it's incredibly encouraging to hear a story about people persuading influential companies to take action. But it's not just about business. As you've said, politicians have to act too. And we've seen politicians sign landmark agreements in the past few years, like the Paris Climate Agreement.
Making history at the UN in New York. As Earth Day was being observed around the planet, a record number of countries signed the historic Paris Accord to slow global warming.
But is there an example of when governments have come together as a result of a campaign and solved a problem?
The most striking example is the ozone layer. And we're very lucky that they did just in time, because it's a problem that if it had been left any longer, it could have become unsolvable. What happened is that for years, we were unknowingly destroying this enormously important protective layer in the upper atmosphere. And the ozone layer protects us because it filters out most of the ultraviolet radiation from the sun. And this ultraviolet light, when it's unfiltered, it can cause problems. It can cause eye damage. It can cause skin cancer. It can harm the immune system. It causes a lot of problems in people and also in animals and indeed in plant life. For decades, we were damaging it because we were using these chemicals called chlorofluorocarbons. They were used in refrigerants. They were used as aerosol propellants. And they had a wide range of industrial uses.
What form did the campaign against CFCs take?
So after the Nature paper by Mario Molina and Sherry Rowlands in 1974 showed that this damage was probably happening in the atmosphere, there was a lot of concern among environmentalists at the time. But it was difficult to pinpoint exactly what could be done at first. We had to get more science, and people had to look at in some detail what was causing the problem. But the first solution really was to get companies to use different chemicals. The companies that were producing the CFCs were actually able to produce substitutes which didn't harm the ozone layer. But at first, they had no reason to do so because they weren't being regulated. The CFCs were not classed as a pollutant. And they were able to point to this lack of evidence for some years of a hole in the ozone layer to say, oh, well, you know, we're not causing any problems. It was only when the British Antarctic Survey did some research in the 1980s and they came back and they produced another paper in 1985 that showed that there was a massive hole in the ozone layer over the South Pole, and that these chlorofluorocarbons were to blame.
Evidence like these satellite pictures of the South Pole alerted scientists that the problem hadn't gone away. The white line around the rim is the equator. The pink area in the middle is extremely low concentrations of ozone.
And it was at that point that governments realized that really they needed to act.
Why do you think politicians at the time were so responsive to the issue of the ozone layer?
In some ways, we were very lucky with the politicians at the time, because this was the mid-1980s.
The challenges we face today are both numerous and complex.
In charge of the United States, we had President Ronald Reagan.
Advances in science, technology, and economic development produced new and unwelcome threats to our environment and the quality of life.
Who had himself suffered from skin cancer, which of course is one of the ailments that come from reducing the ozone layer. And in the UK, there was Margaret Thatcher as Prime Minister.
When I last spoke here 4 years ago, on the 40th anniversary of the United Nations, the message that I and others like me gave was one of encouragement to the organisation to play the great role allotted to it. Of all the challenges faced by the world community in those 4 years, one has grown clearer than any other in both urgency and importance. I refer to the threat to our global environment.
And she was actually a chemist by training. So I'm told that when the papers on ozone damage started coming out, she read all these scientific papers herself. She didn't rely on civil servants or anyone summarising them for her. She went right into the science herself. She could see that it was a problem, and she could see that it was urgent and that we needed action.
Great damage is being done to the ozone layer by the production of halons and chlorofluorocarbons. But at least we have recognized that reducing and eventually stopping the emission of CFCs is one positive thing we can do about the menacing accumulation of greenhouse gases.
So these two leaders really got the rest of the world together and got a treaty, and a very successful treaty it was too. The Montreal Protocol of 1987 phased out chlorofluorocarbons, and it's also had more impact on climate change than most other international agreements, including the Paris Agreement.
And that in itself is incredible, but I think it seems particularly incredible today, Fiona, when we're sitting in a time where a lot of leaders are not following the science on the climate.
The United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord.
Do you think that politicians today could be that responsive?
There's no reason why politicians today cannot be as responsive. All they need is political will. We haven't really done as well on climate change as we did on the Montreal Protocol. And there are many reasons for that. One of them is that the chemicals causing the ozone layer were very clearly identified and they came from a few sources. Whereas the greenhouse gases that cause the climate crisis come from a huge number of different sources and different activities. We're all using fossil fuels around the world every day of our lives. And so fossil fuels are so pervasive that it's very difficult to phase them out.
After this, why it's important to be optimistic in the fight against the climate crisis. The way you've campaigned, Janet, would be described as grassroots. And I was just imagining for a second that somebody might be listening who is feeling very anxious about what is happening to our planet and what is happening to the climate and might feel like they're quite powerless to do everything. But would you say that actually you can achieve a huge amount even just where you live, on your street or in your community?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Start where you are. And we've just now, in the Warwick District Council, we've said that private landlords will be fined, I think it's £1,000, if they do not insulate their properties properly.
Wow.
So that's a campaign worth going for. You know, we now need to check up on all the private landlords and make sure they understand this and help them to know what is the best insulation, what is the best way to do it. Back in the days when we had snow, you could walk around the streets and those houses that had snow on the roof, you know, were insulated. And the ones that have got no snow on the roof obviously have no insulation. So you start with them and say, excuse me, are you aware you can get free insulation from this company or that company or the district council or whoever? That's the campaign at the moment, is to reduce people's need to burn carbon and waste it. It's terrible.
And, you know, we're up against fossil fuel companies, banks.
Yep.
Are you optimistic that those forces can be counteracted in this fight for the climate?
Only with difficulty. I wanted the Leamington Town Council to change its banking into something ethical. Well, first of all, we couldn't find an ethical bank that would deal with local authorities. So we're back with one of what I would call the really dirty banks. And the banks are complicit, really seriously complicit in the opposing climate change by backing fossil fuel industry.
Just finally, Janet, are you optimistic about what the climate change movement can achieve today?
I wish I could say yes to that. It's making progress, but it is very slow.
But what isn't lacking is visible campaigns and campaigners. And over the last couple of years, we've seen Extinction Rebellion protests, the school strikes, divestment when people move their money away from fossil fuels. What do you think of all of these movements?
So the environmental movement over the past two decades has really moved from being quite localised campaigns in a lot of parts of the world to being really global. There are organisations of businesses as well, which is a new thing. Because in the past, really, the only involvement of business in environmental campaigns was negative. Whereas now you are actually seeing companies coming forward and saying, we will meet net zero, we will reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and all the rest of it. Now, of course, those companies have to be held to account. But the fact that companies are taking action is positive. And we're also seeing legislation around the world, because although we might not be seeing as much movement as we would like in global terms, we are seeing a lot of efforts take place at a local and a sub-national level in places where the national governments are not doing so well.
Do you think that in our response to the climate crisis, we have the right balance between acknowledging we're in a crisis, but also being hopeful about what we can do to combat it?
Environmentalism cannot exist without hope, because it's the hope of a beautiful planet that keeps people going. We saw in lockdown, when suddenly people could hear birdsong and when people could see the Himalayas in India or could see long distances in other countries without smog and air pollution, people really woke up to the fact that we are damaging the planet, and it's so much more beautiful when we work with nature rather than to carry on destroying it. So it can be done. And the really important thing is to realise that there is a continuity here, that people who are coming along today and starting their activism with huge enthusiasm, it's really important to realise that there have been people before who have done similar things with equal enthusiasm and who have succeeded. So if ever you start to feel downhearted, then think about the successes of the past, think about what people power has achieved, and think about the ways that they achieved it as well, because people have got to think smartly about how to solve environmental problems.
Fiona, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Fiona Harvey and Janet Alty. Read Fiona's article about the green movement's successes at theguardian.com, along with some of the amazing reporting she and others from the environment team have been doing as part of The Guardian's Climate Pledge 2020. If you want to find out more about the pledge and the steps we're taking to prioritise the climate emergency in our journalism and our business decisions, go to the website. And if you want to support The Guardian and our environmental reporting, please visit theguardian.com/climatefocus. Thanks to Fiona and Janet for speaking to us today. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers and Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.